Welcome everybody to the University of South Australia. I'm Erica Green, the Director of the University's Anne and Gordon Samstag Museum of Art. It gives me tremendous pleasure to welcome you all here this evening and to launch the Double Helix Art and the Moving Image Symposium, presented by the 2009 Big Pond Adelaide Film Festival. The Samstag Museum is absolutely delighted to be hosting this important symposium. Our involvement has grown from our successful collaboration with the Film Festival in producing the Lynette Walworth Duality of Light exhibition, which you will see downstairs in the Samstag Museum. The symposium today has been curated by Julianne Pearce, and I'd like to congratulate Julianne and the Film Festival team, particularly Adele Hahn and, of course, Katrina Sedgwick. I must also mention the crucial and hard work contributed by my own staff, Sarah Wall, Jane Wicks and Emma Epstein from the Samstag Museum. I hope you enjoy this fantastic program of talks and conversations and the exceptional list of speakers and participants, many from overseas. I extend a special welcome to Rafael Lozano Hema. Rafael is a distinguished Mexican-Canadian artist known for his large-scale new technology interactive installations. Welcome also to Lawrence Cardish, Senior Curator, Department of Film and Media at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Lawrence will present a keynote lecture tomorrow from 11 a.m, followed by Isaac Julian in discussion with Conrad Bottom. A very special feature also tomorrow, we will have Lynette Walworth, our festival commissioned artist responsible for the marvellous Duality of Light, our second plug for that exhibition, speaking about her work in conversation with Ross Gibson. Should you have any queries about the lecture or venue, please ask outside one of the staff members outside in the Bradley Forum area outside. Following tonight's keynote address, drinks will also be served outside the Bradley Forum, and the guest editor, Scott Hessels, will launch Screenplay and its new Filter magazine. And just to note, Duality of Light will be open from 1 p.m. on Saturday and 12:30 on Sunday in the Samstag Museum so that symposium visitors can stop by at the exhibition during lunch. It now gives me great pleasure to ask Julianne Pearce to introduce tonight's keynote presenter, Rafael Lozano Hema. Julianne, thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Erica. And before I introduce Rafael, I'd just like to acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. So it's a real pleasure for me to be here tonight and to welcome you all here and to welcome our speakers, our local, national and international speakers who are here for the symposium. It's a fantastic initiative of the Big Pond Adelaide Film Festival to include this art and moving image program within the context of the film festival. I know Katrina and Adele are very keen to engage with different disciplines and look at how disciplines such as visual arts have a very rich and ongoing dialogue with cinema and the moving image. So we're going to be fleshing out that relationship over the next couple of days. I'd also really like to thank Samstag for hosting the symposium and for supporting events such as this, and especially Erica and her team, and also the support of the Australia Council Visual Arts Board. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce Rafael Lozano Hema, our keynote speaker. I've known Rafael for several years now and have followed his work for many years. And he really is an artist that pushes the boundaries of interactivity and the screen in public space. He's going to talk tonight about some of his projects where he has created architectural spaces within urban spaces. He works with light, sound. He's interested in surveillance. And he's particularly interested in the audience and creating a space for the audience to interact in public space and with his artworks. And he's going to expand also on his own relationship and influence from cinema and how he works with ideas of character, projection, the screen, and so on. Rafael is a highly recognised international artist. He's Mexican-Canadian, and he represented Mexico in the Venice Biennale in 2007 in a wonderful pavilion with several very impressive works. His work is held in the collections of MoMA in New York, the Tate Modern, and also in the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart. So Raphael might even talk about MONA, as he likes to call it. Raphael has won many awards, including two BAFTAs for interactive art in 2002 and 2005, and he was the recipient of a Rockefeller Ford Fellowship in 2003. Last year, he had two major works in the UK, Under Scan, which was presented in Trafalgar Square, and also Frequency and Volume at the Barbican. His work is seen in Europe, Asia and America, and hopefully more in Australia over the next few years. And people might have seen Raphael's work, Homographies, in the 2006 Sydney Biennale. So after Raphael, please stay on and join us for the launch of Screenplay, the Anat Filter magazine launch, which will be launched by Scott Hessel and followed by Drinking and Cheese. So I welcome everyone, and over to Raphael.
Thank you so much. First thing I'll do is kill the music by revealing that I'm playing iTunes in the back. It's like really bad form. Like, you can see all of my little devices. Okay, pretend you didn't see anything. Now I'm going to turn off the light by pressing this nifty button. And that worked. It's a delight to be here tonight. Maybe you can't see me. Is that okay? Or, yeah, we're fine. It's exciting to be here. Thank you so much for having me, the festival, the museum, Julianne, everybody. I'm living in Canada, in Montreal. We're 20 degrees below. So it's a delight to be here with this incredible weather. I'm lying to my wife about it because, you know, I'm pretending it's raining and it's awful. Today I'm just going to show you very quickly about six or seven projects in public space, mostly, which utilize technologies in a performative way. I decided to do that, show you like brief clips of different projects as opposed to go more into depth into just a couple of them, because I thought it'd be more interesting to do a panorama. And then in discussion, maybe after the presentation, we can zero in on any project that might interest you. One of the very, very large pieces that I did in public space was a piece commissioned for the Millennium Celebrations in Mexico City. It was in the Zocalo Square, which is the third largest square in the world. And contrary to, you know, what Jean-Michel Jarre did in the Pyramids of Egypt, which is this kind of post-colonial approach where this French guy shows, you know, Egyptians how exciting their culture is, what I decided to do is not a show. I decided to do a light installation where there was like a three-dimensional sort of interface where anybody on the internet could log on and use what you're seeing right now, which would allow you to direct searchlights that were placed in the buildings surrounding the square and design this huge light sculptures. And basically you could visualize it in 3D more or less how you would like it. And then once you were happy with your design, you would put your name and your dedication and perhaps some comments and send them to Mexico, where every night the designs would be actually rendered in the sky. So here is the interface, and then this is a scene in Mexico City, and you know, the 28th of January at 3 a.m. in the morning, with the designs actually sort of being rendered in the sky by these powerful spotlights. Thanks to the beautiful pollution that we have in Mexico City, the lights were really potent. They could be seen from a 15-kilometer radius. And the piece in itself is just a parade of these designs. So there's no narrative, no catharsis, no privileged viewpoint, no proscenium. The idea is to actually, in the video you don't really see it, but it really takes over all of your peripheral vision, because as you're walking around, all of these lights are just sort of reorganizing themselves in space. As they received instructions from the internet. Over the course of 2 weeks, every night from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., Every 8 seconds, a new design would appear in the night sky. And then now you see here at the 4th of January, like at 8 p.m., just people going about their own business, and the lights are just constantly transforming. So many times I say that my work is not really a Sonne Lumière spectacle as much as it is like a public fountain. It's just something that is constantly there. It doesn't necessitate like this kind of linear attention. And you'll see how every time that the lights move, they stop for a brief second. And at that moment, what we would do is we would photograph the designs from several webcams around the city and build a web page for each and every participant. So here's examples of web pages. What you see on the left is the actual virtual view of what the person had actually done. And on the right is actual photographs taken from the very same vantage point to show people that their, you know, design really did take place in the Zócalo. And this was very important because in 1999, Mexico was still under the PRI government. And as you may know, Mexicans had been voting against them for 80 years and nothing had happened. So the idea that participation was a vehicle for transformation was a really sort of crucial thing. And this kind of souvenir or this kind of takeover of this public space was important. And you see that at the top, there's a comment section. Those comments were completely uncensored, which was a very important part of this project. Because at the time, the Zapatista rebellion was actually quite active in Mexico electronically. And, you know, most of the comments were things like, I dedicate this to Margarita, who's at the hospital. I hope you get better. But we got all sorts of other things, everything from Zapatista slogans all the way to sort of 27 marriage proposals, football scores, poetry, whatever. And the idea is that you take over a space like that and you personalize it.
Un espectáculo muy, muy bonito. Padrísimos.
Son muy potentes.
Hermosas. Me dijo mi mamá que esas luces son, las puede manejar uno que tenga ¿qué?
Internet.
Ah, sí, vamos a verlas.
No, más que nada son sistemas computarizados manejados de luces, pero no interviene nada de internet.
Sí,
son sistemas.
Sí, sí interviene. ¿Eso sí es internet? Sí. De cada parte de la República hicieron sus diseños para que aquí juntaran las luces y se vieran.
Revista es.
5 minutos. Los diseños y pasan el nombre y la dirección del chavo que los hizo.
Y ahora que venimos al Zócalo, vemos las luces y ahora decimos, ahora estamos en un Hollywood, pero mexicano.
Sí, muy bonito. Que es una obra de arte.
Uno mismo manda su diseño.
El mejor es el que hace así el techo.
Me preguntaba que si tenían algún significado cruzados y todo eso, por la cuestión de las constelaciones.
Nos parece una... So through the media, but also through word of mouth, people would find out that, in fact, if those lights were moving, it's because somebody had actually activated it. And working with this kind of technology is somehow humbling, because if nobody participates, those lights just actually turned off and there's nothing to see. We actually got 800,000 participants from 89 countries. And it's one of the interesting things about the internet is that it lets you disintermediate the art experience and allows people to, you know, very directly sort of take over the platform. This project has been shown several times after. Here's a version of the project at the Place Bellecour in Lyon in 2004. And we're shooting this with a better camera, so you see the beams a little bit better. But the kind of thing that I'm really interested in is in this idea of all these people that are just underneath promenading in public space. So there's this desire to create this sort of ephemeral, eccentric interventions in public space that bring back this idea of just being in that public space without necessarily shopping. In these new versions of the project, we actually have interfaces, actual computers on site that people can use to also create their own designs. In general, projects like these are acknowledgedly working with a scale that is quite intimidating. As you may know, like all of these searchlights have a very dark and ominous background because of Albert Speer's memorials and the Nuremberg basically monuments of intimidation, as well as the internet itself, which is, as you know, developed by the Pentagon. So the idea is to try and misuse these kinds of technologies in a way that, you know, allows for people to have a certain sense of takeover of public space. I'm very interested in the idea of art of instructions, like this kind of SolarWinds idea of you have these instructions and then they can be, you know, in this case, remotely activated. And projects like this tour, so they generate very different kinds of experiences as we see them in different cities. After I did this project, unfortunately, I became the searchlight artist, and that's a really bad thing to be. So another project that came up in 2001, I did a piece that transformed a Schouwburg plain in Rotterdam for Cultural Capital of Europe. And it was a piece inspired in this particular engraving from Samuel von Hoogstraten, a disciple of Rembrandt who, like Rembrandt, worked with techniques of anamorphosis and trompe l'oeil and this shadow place to sort of understand perspective. And one of the things that I was really fascinated about this particular piece is, as you can see, the larger shadows are demonic, whereas the smaller ones are angelical and pure, and the relationship of scale to this kind of affirmation was interesting to me. So, in part, inspired by that engraving, what we did, that engraving was actually done in Rotterdam in 1675. We made a very, very large shadow play in the Schouwburg plain. This is actually 1,200 square meters of interactive projections. It's basically over 1,000 portraits of people taken in the city where the project is shown. They're projected, this is a 60 meter wide projection, by 25 meters high, and they're projected with these very powerful projectors, but there's also two very bright light sources in the floor which basically wash out the portrait. And as people walk across the actual square, there they block the bottom light and cast their shadow onto the facade. And then as they grow, as they move close to or far away from the facade, their shadow grows from 2 meters all the way up to 25 meters. And it's a very sort of playful, carnivalesque piece because there's no instructions about what to do or not to do. And quite naturally, people oftentimes would sort of grow their image to match one of the portraits and animate it. So what we ended up having is, over the course of the 3 weeks that this project was on, people would just sort of go to the movies or to the theater or back home after work or whatever, and then find themselves as a player in this huge shadow play. The project generated just, you know, like a lot of really crazy participation. We got a lot of stuff that we just could not have imagined before we did it. We got like a man on a wheelchair project himself 25 meters high and crush everybody under his wheels and derive a lot of pleasure from this. It would depend very much on the time of night and also the day of the week. Tuesdays was methadone night at the church next door, so there's a lot of heroin addicts. There's lots of breakdancing, it really depended on the time of day. And technologically, the system worked with a surveillance mechanism that allowed the computer to detect where the shadows were. What you're seeing here is actually sort of the very first version of that tracking system is much better now. But basically what we would do is automatically, when a shadow and a portrait would match, would overlap, the system would send a little MIDI trigger to the public space so that you could hear a small sound like tick, just so you knew that, okay, that portrait had been activated. And most importantly, once all of the portraits in a given scene were revealed, automatically the system would black out and cue a new image, in a way frustrating representation, because this project is not really about the portraits, it's about becoming the portraits, about activating them. So you'll see in this scene, these people sort of collaborate or whatever, and they see all the portraits, the system shuts down, cues a new image, and people are in a way invited to sort of reorganize in public space to establish a new narrative. This kind of project, with most interactive art, with most electronic art, including my own, there's often a very sort of annoying necessity to explain people, press here, or don't do this, or don't do that. With shadows, there's a really great advantage, and that's that we all have a very sophisticated language of what can be done with our shadow. There's a sophisticated shadow puppetry or theater tradition in most cultures, and you know, we've all sort of played around in our rooms with a light source. So in fact, the interface is intuitive, let's say. And the actual surveillance mechanism is revealed in the square, projected on that screen together with explanations in English and Dutch. So if you're the nerdy type like me, then you might go there to find out what's going on. But 90% of the people didn't really care about that part. They would just sort of start enacting these kinds of ad hoc plays, you know, all of a sudden. So, I mean, I'm showing you like 4 minutes of footage, but it really was like a very, very intense. She was there abusing her boyfriend for a couple of hours. He seemed to enjoy that. I mean, some people didn't care about the portraits, which was fine. I mean, they just wanted to sort of work with this monstrous scale. So the project is kind of fun because it's completely out of control. So it was very important that that my pieces have this idea of no one tells you what to do or not to do. Oftentimes when we first have this project, what we notice is, you know, some 17-year-old guys, they go in and, you know, they do like, oh, I have a big penis, and you know, that's fine. They do that for about 3 seconds, and then they go, oh, I'm so radical, and then they think of something else to do. So it's kind of self-organizing, and that's a really fun part of it. Also, the other thing that's interesting about this huge shadow place is that, you know, you have a general tableau. There's you know, a lot of people can participate at once, but you're also your own image. You know, you have your own sort of thing going, and so in that sense, it's an interesting experiment for that kind of thing. Now, as with the other project that I just showed you and the ones I'm about to show you, these projects again don't exist without the integral sort of participation of the public. So, in fact, we've done this project several times over in other cities. Like, let me just show you. This is in a city in Austria, at the Hauptplatz in Linz. When we did this project, a software company, SAP, sponsored it. And it was advertised, Rafael Lozano Hammer Body Movies, 9 p.m. Friday. It opens at the Hauptplatz. And so all the sponsors and whatever came over. And then the piece started, and there was nothing to see because no one was casting shadows. So for what seemed like the longest 40 seconds in my life, like all the sponsors just kind of looked at me and said, what's going on? And then finally a curly-haired boy went in and started doing his shadows, and then everybody joined them and the piece began. So if no one's there, all you see is just this brightly illuminated image, and that's the end of it. In Linz, what we did is we shut down car traffic too, which just gives a further sort of sense of entitlement for people to sort of take over. I've done a lot of shadow plays, and I'll show you several of them because I do think that they have a connection to this idea of moving image and, you know, being at a film festival. I think it's interesting to think about that kind of corporeality of the shadow in terms of moving image. So a project that I just sort of revived at the Barbican Centre in London is a project that also uses shadows. It's called Frequency and Volume. Originally, it was premiered in Mexico City at a time when the Mexican government was shutting down pirate radio stations or informal radio stations that the indigenous communities of Chiapas and Guerrero were building. And I began to be very fascinated with the idea of the radio spectrum as a public space and who has access to it. So, in fact, this project is something like this. Basically, the system casts your shadow and it converts your body into an antenna that can eavesdrop into any frequency between 150 kilohertz and 1.5 gigahertz. So as you move from left to right, you tune different frequencies. And then as you move close to or far from the screen, the volume of that channel that you're tuning gets louder or less loud. You can listen to the police, you can listen to ambulances, air traffic control, cell phones, AM, FM, shortwave, and whatnot. And the idea is just to create like a tactical sort of platform for people to eavesdrop into these radio waves. You can have up to a maximum. At the Barbican, we had up to 48 simultaneous independent channels of sound. And so it's kind of like a music instrument. As you move close to or far away, you create this sounds that, like maybe somebody's tuning like the digital pagers, and then somebody's tuning a country and western radio station or whatnot. The version at the Barbican was in a place called The Curve, which is a very long wall. It's like 80 meters long. And it was just really exciting because The Curve is a weird kind of public space in a way. It's a free space to be there, and it's also like a normal sort of passageway for people, so they would sort of get caught into this and then listen into the radio electric spectrum in London. And as you may know, in Britain, the pirate radio station is something that's very important. It's where most DJs actually made their original name. And there's incredibly intense electromagnetic activity in London, and so you could sort of eavesdrop in it, but also just sort of have this sort of sense of your target or your presence actually being the one that was doing the listening. The piece is also accompanied by all of the antennas and radio scanners and so on, and all of the gear that makes this happen. I always show that equipment. I always show sort of how the project actually functions technologically. I find that important. I call it, I know it's pretentious, but I call it the Brechtian moment, because it's this moment where you sort of reveal the way in which it all functions. And everybody is in on the, you know, on how the simulation takes place. And it's also, you know, for nerds, it's a really good thing to do. So all the gear is there. Another piece, okay, I'll show you another shadow piece in a second, but now I'll show you something that's a little bit more sculptural. This is a project that was premiered in Switzerland. I'm very interested in materializing surveillance, how to take a surveillance system and then actually sort of interpret that data into something that is material and iconic and symbolic. So what I did is I'm working here with the, you know, sort of the fetish of authority, this belt, this paternal symbol, this, you know, just sort of quotidian object. And what I did is I put all of these belts suspended from these motors. And as you walk into the room, they all turn to you. So their belt buckles just face you. And as you walk around the room, they very, very slowly actually rotate and just face you. If you're alone, then this is what you see. They all sort of rotate for you. If you're with several people, then they start getting very confused, which is great. You get a little bit of turbulence. Maybe a belt that is in between two people starts going into an eddy, or it stays static or whatnot. But the idea of having this kind of very predatorial presence was important in this project, and they're actually military belts. But it was fun because two friends of mine from Spain, who are gay, they found it really homoerotic, and I thought, okay, well, sure, that's not what I was thinking, but that's okay. I love it when my work actually has many other interpretations, and people sort of make it their own and come up with their own sort of interpretation of the piece. What else? I mean, it's just like, so the surveillance mechanism is right there in that little box, and then, all the motors are basically like just puppets. Back to Shadows, this is a project that originally was also commissioned in England by a development agency in the East Midlands. Bless their heart, they believe that art can actually revitalize the economy of the towns and so on. And that's really exciting because one of the things that I do a lot is I meet these politicians who want to sort of renovate and revitalize their economy. And oftentimes what the politician means by revitalization is putting cobblestones, 19th century lampposts, and some Gap stores. So it's exciting when there's a couple of politicians who think, no, let's do something eccentric, let's do something that's different. And they, in the East Midlands, they commissioned this enormously ambitious work, which we presented in five cities in the East Midlands. And then just a few months ago, we did it also in Trafalgar Square. So back to the Shadows, but at a different scale. In over 2,000 square meters, we cast this very, very bright light, which casts people's shadows on the floor. And as you walk around, you find a number again of portraits, except this time they're interactive video portraits. We have over 1,000 video portraits of the city where it's been shown, except that when you uncover them with your shadow, the computer actually activates them so that they establish eye contact with you. So as you're walking around the square, as you put your shadow on top of them, they actually wake up and check you out. It's a really weird, uncomfortable feeling. And for as long as you're on top of them, they will just sort of stay there checking you out. It's not really a loop, we call it scrubbing. So basically they kind of go fast and then slow, and we just sort of randomize a little bit how they'll establish eye contact. And then when you're tired of the portrait, you can move away, walk away, and then the portrait gets tired of you as well, and it goes back to sleep and then eventually disappears. And the portraits can appear anywhere in the entire square, so there's no repeatability to the project. And so, here you see like people just walk away, portrait disappears. I mean, it just basically goes back to sleep and then disappears. So I was very inspired by Morel's invention, a beautiful, if you haven't read it, it's incredible. It's Adolfo Bioy Casares' 1941 novel about this new kind of post-photographic device that could capture presence in 3D. It's a beautiful story. Borges called it the perfect book. And so the idea of this kind of phantasmagoria of capturing this presence and then just playing it back was a part of this project. Technologically, we included like basically the brightest projector in the world. It makes images that are 70 by 70 meters. And then these robotic projectors, which could place the portraits anywhere around the square. But more importantly, what we did is we developed a tracking system, sort of like a camera surveillance system, which you see right here, that not only detects where people are, but it predicts where people will be in the future. So you see the people on the right there, the little crosshair is where they're going to be following sort of their trajectory. And that information is important for the system because, in fact, like say that you take this guy over here, the crosshair is somewhere going to be somewhere here. So the computer figures out which projector can actually put a portrait in the path of the person walking by. And that's important because we didn't want people, we didn't want the portraits to come to the people. We wanted people to go to the portraits. And so that was kind of how we did it. And also technologically, it was complex because as you can see, the portraits, no matter from where they're projected, but from all around, they're actually scaled and rotated and keystone deformed so that they're actually perfect size to your shadow. And that was also quite a difficult thing to do. But from the point of view of actually experiencing the piece, all you see is just being, you know, just people being inside of your shadow at the right scale. In terms of the project, how we sort of workshopped it, we worked with local filmmakers who would go out to rock concerts, and they would go out to community centers, universities, whatever, and get volunteers to sort of represent themselves. And people were completely free to do whatever they wanted to do in this project. The only thing we would ask them is at one point, look straight at the camera. And that point of eye contact is what we would trigger the moment that you would see them. So here's some examples of some of the people portrayed. You know, they were just, we had all sorts of stuff. We had, like, from people just saying hi to sign language. We had people taking off their clothes. We had people dancing. We had just a whole bunch of things. So, I mean, as you look at a work like this and you compare it, say, to some of the masters of video art, and you're thinking about Gary Hill or Bill Viola or any of these very sophisticated images, my work is really not sophisticated at all. It's all about this capturing of self-representation. And so the feeling of it is very different. In 06, I started doing a lot of projects with biometrics, so sort of following on this idea of surveillance and how to actually materialize all of this information. I just bought some heart rate sensors, and I started working with this idea of vital signs. So this project here is a project called Pulse Room, which is basically the cylinders, the sensors that are not unlike what you might find at a gym, which basically measure electrical activity of your heart. And then as you grip them, as you hold them, computer detects your heartbeat and it puts it into a light bulb, which, you know, then sort of has your recording. The sensor actually doesn't just tell you the heart rate, it also gives you systolic and diastolic activity. So we actually get 11 parameters of information from the sensor. And then what we try and do is we exaggerate those parameters in such a way that the each of the light bulb pulses is quite different. So at the beginning of this particular installation / performance, what happens is you have 100 incandescent light bulbs, or 300, I have a version now with 300. As Burroughs said, bigger is better and better is best. This is the beginning of it. I was first, I couldn't help myself. So here I am, and this is my heartbeat. And then as you release the sensor, the heartbeat moves to the very, very first light bulb in the array. And then here comes a second participant. This is the mother of the sponsor. And notice how her heart rate is different, but also, you know, the attack on the tungsten filament is very different. The amplitude of that in itself is very different. And then again, as she releases the sensor, her recording goes to the first light bulb, and mine gets bumped one position down. Now here comes my friend, who is a raver and drinks a lot of Red Bull. So his heart looks like this. Boom, 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 boom. And again, like, we all sort of moved down one position. Here comes the curator who was freaked out and thought that the project was not going to work. So his heart looked like this. And then, you know, once 100 people have participated, the entire room gets populated by these vital signs. And after 101 people participate, your recording disappears from the room as a little memento mori, you know, of just sort of time passing. And if you walk into the room at any given time, I mean, you're basically walking into the 100 most recent recordings. And the sense of what you, when you're inside of this room, it's kind of destabilizing. It's not particularly pleasant. But I compare it a little bit to sort of minimalist composers like Conlon Nancarrow or Steve Reich or Glenn Branca, where repetitive sequences of motion, you know, sort of create a greater kind of syncopation or arrhythmia or resonance. And I've done this kind of project in many different scales, and I'll show you a different one in a second. Back to surveillance and materialization of surveillance, this project was premiered at the Venice Biennale, and it's basically these Eames plastic molded chairs, except that as you walk by them, the computer detects your presence and it generates movement over them. The actual mathematics of fluid dynamics are embedded into these sculptures. And as several people, for instance, walk around them, their waves will interact with each other and create a more chaotic kind of response. So the idea is that with kinetic sculpture, you get, on the one hand, you get like the aleatory, the random, say a Caldera mobile, which moves at random with wind or whatnot, or you get this kind of animatronic pieces, say a Paul McCarthy, you know, sort of like a guy humping a sheep or something, which are sort of pre-programmed. With this kind of installation, there is no pre-programming. You set up the math, and then it really does have movements which are not predetermined. They're not pre-established or pre-programmed. They're actually emerge from the actual presence of other people around them. So I think that these kinds of mathematics of recursive algorithms, cellular automata, chaos theory, and so on, really help in designing new kinds of environments or sculptures which behave in ways that might even surprise the programmer. And of course, if no one is moving, they all sort of quiet down and they just stay static. And the idea of working with this icon of modern design of this Eames chair was very important, because, as you know, this is an archetype of sort of democratic design of modularity. And the idea of introducing a bit of eccentricity into that was important, was interesting. And in a different room, as with other pieces, the actual surveillance mechanism is revealed, so that people would be able to see exactly how the tracking mechanism was working and whatnot. With the biometrics, I self-exploit many ideas, and I'm criticized for this, because I guess that, especially in new media, there's this insistence on this stupid word "new," which is ridiculous. The fact is that I call myself experimental because I like to experiment with what happens with different scales. This is a very, very sort of similar device that what you saw at the Venice Biennale, but in a big park in New York City. So what we did is we placed 200 theatrical spotlights, and pretty much like with the system that you saw in Pulse Room, you grip your sensor, and you gradually sort of take control of the 200,000 watts of light, and then the entire park is sort of beating at your rate. And then as you release the sensor, it, you know, goes to the very first spotlight and bumps everybody down one position. And in this particular park, this is a just beautiful park, it's called Madison Square Park. It was great because people could walk along the central oval and be completely surrounded by all of this data. And that was just sort of again this idea of creating more of an environment that is reacting to people. So let me just show you there's another scene. This is a nice scene. It's just really pretty. But it is eye candy. I mean, in the end, it just depends what the commission is. I mean, in this particular case, I felt that New York, has so many memorials, and there's just a very intense sense of necrophilia going on, and it's very important to create these environments of ambience where people just sort of chill out and sit down, and there's no reason to be there, but they still go. So that's that project. This, I have only two more, so don't panic. This one is a project of sort of comparative reporting, What we did is we recorded 1,600 reporters, 800 from Mexico and 800 from the United States. And then we, this video that you're seeing is a shadow box. It's a little sort of computer display that has a built-in surveillance system that sort of casts your shadow onto the display. And then as you move over the portraits, the actual reporters tell you the news. And what the system does is it, every 3 minutes, it reclassifies the database of reporters according to gender, race, or geography. So in this particular scene, you're seeing male, female. Males are on the left and females on the right. And very quickly, you can see, you know, certain, you can make certain generalizations about the way that we represent ourselves, say, as Mexicans. For instance, the colors of the sets are extremely saturated compared to the Americans, but the Americans are louder in decibels. Or, you know, in terms of male, female. I mean, it's just a tool for this massive visualization. So you're seeing 800 videos at once. And the sound part of it, you know, you can cut between the male and the female, or the Mexicans and Americans and whatnot. And we just did this project in a large scale. So let me show you. This is at a gallery in London, where you've got there's the females on the left and the males on the right. So just a way to sort of cast people's presence onto the media and just sort of massively see what happens. Okay, and the last project I'll show you tonight is a memorial for a massacre. As you may know, in the Mexican government actually killed 300 students in the 2nd of October of 1968. You know, at the time, this was all taboo and very closed, and nobody knew about it. But about 10 years ago, finally, the information came out. The guy who was responsible, mostly, his name is Echeverria. He's now in house arrest. That, you know, that Latin American way of punishing old bastards. So he can sit with his 500 threat count Egyptian cotton sheets because he's too old to go to jail. But anyway, but at least the information is out. And the university's taken over the actual square, and they commissioned me to create a piece for this memorial. And this is a really intensely difficult thing to do, to sort of work with that. Most of the artists that I admire, people like Hans Hakes or Jochen Gertz or Rachel Whiteread, or they're people whose best work, in my opinion, happens in memorials or in works that actually refer to this kind of very sort of dark history. So the project that I proposed is this. It's called Voz Alta, which means loud voice, if you will. And what it is basically a megaphone, not unlike what you may have found at the actual protests of the students in 68. And it's a free megaphone. Anybody can come in and grab it and speak. Except that as you speak onto the megaphone, your voice comes out of it amplified. It's not particularly loud. But at the same time that you do that, a very, very bright searchlight comes out from behind you, from the actual ground of the square where the massacre took place, which is this place. And it sends your light, converts your voice into light. So in fact, this light beam actually oscillates in intensity with your voice. If you're quiet, it's off. And then as you speak, it just sort of scintillates. And what it does is it hits the top of that building you see there, which happens to be the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And it's exactly the office of the minister. He's not there anymore. The earthquake in 84, you know, sort of abandoned that building. So we had the opportunity to really flash it onto it. And when your voice in the form of light hits the top of the building, three more searchlights take the message to the north, towards La Villa, to the Zocalo Square, and to Revolutionary Monument. And so in Mexico City, as you are driving in your car or looking out the window of your office or school or whatever, you would see this lights just sort of blinking. And what you could do is you could actually tune 96.1 FM and listen live to what the light was saying. So what we did is we got broadcast rights for the UNAM, the radio station of the university, to broadcast live, uncensored and unmoderated, what people were saying. And it was just absolutely incredible. We got you know, survivors of the massacre coming in. We got a lot of people from the neighborhood. We got the usual shout outs and so on, but it was very, very moving. We got like a guy said, you know, my name is Edmundo Rodriguez, and I'm here to say that I'm actually the son of one of the soldiers who committed the massacre. And I'm here to say this is a new generation. I want to break from that. I've lived with this guilt all my life. And we were all just fucking like, okay, this is so intense. We got another guy who was said, my name's so-and-so, and I'm here to denounce that I'm a fireman, and I've been in the force for 25 years, and the Mexican government routinely asks us to put a dye, a coloring, in our water tank so that when we spray protesters, it is easier for the police to actually identify the protesters. And I, you know, I'm a fireman because I want to save people's lives. I don't want to be part of the oppressive apparatus. And we're all like, holy shit, this is so intense. The project took place over a couple of weeks, and it was really delightful to see sort of people take over the platform and utilize it. The media in Mexico, of course, to this date, are complicit with what happened in the massacre. Televisa, the main television station at the time, actually reported that there was a little fight and maybe one student died. And what's really interesting is that Televisa did not come to report on this project, which is what I consider my most important project ever. A month later, they came to my gallery in London, Haunch of Venison, because a bunch of rich people were there and whatever. They came to interview me there. And so I took the opportunity to, you know, they asked me about this voice work that I had at Haunch of Venison, and they're, so tell us about this piece. And I said, yeah, this piece is not unlike what I just did in Tlatelolco for the 40th anniversary, which you were not there to cover, motherfuckers. But what I'm saying is it's really frustrating that to this date, with all of the changes and all of the progress in Mexico, you still have this intense sort of pyramidal thing that you cannot break in. So pieces like this, you know, are this temporary moments, you know, where people can sort of self-express. Here's like a little video of the actual, and people were actually called onto that that square, and the government put snipers who shot at the military, and the military shot back. Here, let me just show you. I think it's here.
Esta situación, y no sé, actualmente estamos viendo que...
Checking to see if they have a... No, they don't have it. Okay. Well, anyway, we're working still on this video, but it was a very successful kind of apparatus for sort of activating that. Oh, and I should say, when people weren't speaking live, when they didn't speak on the megaphone, what we would do is we would trigger archival footage from the actual survivors of 68, from intellectuals who were being interviewed, music from 68. So the idea is that the default state of the whole system would broadcast this kind of memory of the people who were actually there in the massacre, and then cut in with people who would live sort of give their voice. So the idea was to reactivate that memory and not make it into sort of a necrophiliac show, but sort of you know, talk about the situation as it is now. So that's my presentation, and I'll turn the lights on. Thank you.
Thanks, Rafael, for a really fantastic overview of your work and very inspiring presentation. I'm just going to kick off with a couple of questions, and then we'll open up to the floor. I was wondering, just in the context of, you know, of the film festival and this being a symposium on art and moving image, that perhaps if you could talk a little bit more about the influence of cinema on your work, and perhaps how you see your work and perhaps sort of interactive work in general as a sort of part of a lineage of cinema. And, you know, I think what's really fascinating about your work, and it harks back to very early days of cinema, to this sense of
wonderment and phantasma, and you're obviously using devices of cinema, you know, screen projection, character light and shadow. So I'm just wondering how you see your work fitting into that sort of chronology of cinema.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't think it's possible today to create visual artwork without referring to cinema. It's basically part of our language or of our blood. Many of the pieces here, like, for instance, Pulse Room, in fact, it's inspired by a movie called Macario. It's a movie from 1951. I called it the Mexican Matrix because it's this guy who is hallucinating. He hasn't eaten in a really long time. And he hallucinates this room full of little candles that flicker, and each of the candles is, in fact, representing one of the people. So oftentimes, a lot of my work is actually inspired by viewing this kind of you know, having that kind of reference. I'm reminded of something that I don't know if it's really true, but they were telling me that when Lumiere Brothers were actually doing their projections, people were not actually watching the film. They would sit oblique to the projection so that they could see the movie here and the machine on the other end. And I think that that's really interesting because I think that's what's happening with electronic art too. A lot of times as we work with these projects, people are very fascinated by the devices that we're utilizing. But ultimately, you know, what maturity will come when the language that is developed out of this electronic art is the content, is what is actually forming this kind of intensity or questioning, and the device is not as important. So I don't know. I think it took cinema a long time to sort of be accepted as one of the fine arts. I think with electronic art, we're seeing the same thing, but now I think we're almost there. I should say, I mean, I think that that cinema it has a place and it has a time, and I think that my work is closest not so much to cinema as it is to performing arts. So the idea that these pieces are performances is an important element of it. There is one thing, though, about cinema that I'm... Cinema and, in general, concerts and so on, is this utopian idea of Frederick Chesky, this American composer who talked about coming together. This idea of a group of people get together in a room to experience a very similar narrative. And I think there's something really magical about that. And it's very simple, but just the complicity of having people experience something together is hopeful, let's say. But other than that, I mean, a lot of the work that I'm doing is more in the expanded cinema kind of tradition. So forever, many filmmakers have wanted to create these larger environments where people walk in and they're kind of part of the film. In Mexico, we had Morton Heilig, who is this guy in the 60s who actually developed the first virtual reality display in Cuernavaca in the 60s. And it was a panoramic cinema experience with sense of smell, with motorized, with sound. So I'm most... Not most interested, but quite interested about the people who have actually wanted to take cinema into a takeover of many perceptual characteristics, including the body. To include the body into the film. So those are the lines that I'm most interested in.
I'd also be interested, perhaps, for you to talk a little bit more about, you know, you said participation as a vehicle for transformation, and I think, you know, one of the reasons why your work is so successful is that it engages with such a broad public, and it's very playful, but it is very political and it's very politically charged. And you know, you talk about, I guess, entitlement and how an audience or public can reclaim public space. So, you know, I'm just perhaps asking if you can talk a little bit more about this idea of sort of transformation and entitlement.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, Churchill once said, we make buildings and buildings make us. The situation today is exactly the opposite. Today, a new building in Adelaide is very similar to one in Madrid or one in London because urban planners, developers, architects are not thinking about, you know, the citizenry and how to represent them, but really they're trying to find the best formulas to most inexpensively create a lodging or create a workplace. And so the solutions are very homogeneous. It's fluorescent light strips, it's corridors with rooms on either ends and so on. And what we're seeing is a crisis of how these public spaces are administered and processed and presented. Shoot, what was the question? It was going somewhere.
How you're motivated by the idea of transformation.
So the idea of participation is this possibility of introducing a sense of relationship, a sense of intimacy, a sense of complicity with your built environment, with other people, so on and so forth. I think that ultimately participation and empowerment and la 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 la, in my work, actually works at the level of special effects. So I would say that only 15% of people, especially with the big projects, care whether it's art or not. Most people just are attracted by the scale of it and by the use of these kind of large corporate technologies that then, you know, they can actually activate. And I'm completely fine with that. The idea that this participation may come from the world of special effects, I'm very, very comfortable with that idea. I think it's important that these projects have different entry points. And then if you are interested in reading it politically, you can. I mean, it depends on the project as well, of course. But then ultimately with participation, the other thing that's happening, in my opinion, a lot of my work now is going into museums or galleries and so on and so forth. And I think that the change that's happening is that it used to be the case that you would go to a museum to look at a work and, you know, just sort of be inspired by it, you know, just sort of contemplate it and learn about it and just sort of get what the artist was trying to do. Today, I think the situation has changed quite radically. It is the artwork that is looking at the public. It is the artwork that is listening and sensing and expecting something out of the curators and the public. And the artworks get really bored, you know, of the way in which they're being presented. They're bored of this sort of condescending and paternalistic way in which this pedagogical didacticism and necrophilia takes place in many so-called exhaustive collections. So what I have found is that when it's most fun, it's when you realize that these artworks need to play off each other and with the public. Duchamp said, "Le regard fait le tableau." It is the look that makes the painting. And any museum curator, critic, artist who accepts that importance of the public, that reading, as integral to the work, I think will benefit from this notion of participation. The other thing that's beautiful about the word participation is I was in a show recently in SF MoMA called The Art of Participation, and what they did, which I think is really smart, is they took this interactive art and they put it in the context of pieces by Cage and by, you know, a very large number of other people who've experimented with this idea of the prevalence of the public. And I think that's really, really healthy for electronic art because, sadly, you know, 90% of what we do in electronic art is gimmicky and is primitive and infantile. I have a friend in Mexico, Jesús Rodríguez. At the time, I was doing technological art, and she's a big theater activist woman. She said to me, "Rafael, how do you dare put something as sophisticated and rich as theater with something as primitive as technology?" You know, and I totally get her point, you know, because in the end, it's not right to just put shows together, in my opinion, only by virtue of the fact that they're made with a platform, which otherwise, in any other world, the world of economy, of politics, of weaponry, and so on and so forth, technology is, you know, insidious and everywhere. So why was I saying that? I'm jet lagged a little bit. Anyway, participation. So just to finish, the idea of talking this as art of participation is something that then connects us to Lydia Clark and Elio Tichica. It connects us to all these other people that are admirable, and then people are not so focused on whether it's interactive or one bit interesting.
Okay. Are there any questions from the floor?
Yes, I was just wondering, were you trained as an artist, or did you train as an artist, or as an engineer, or in cinema? or all of them, or none at all?
Yeah,
how did you get to working in this?
Yeah, I actually studied chemistry, so I have a chemistry degree. Recently, I found my thesis, and I could not believe I wrote that because I forgot everything about it. But my family are nightclub owners in Mexico, and all my life I've been surrounded by artists and deviants and so on. So as soon as I finished chemistry, I actually took a job at a corporation, and it was just awful. And so I hung out with the wrong crowd and became an artist. The first part of my training was actually in radio. I started doing radio art, and I had the luxury of meeting Dick Higgins, who was just an incredible force and influence in my career. So very early on, I met him when I was like 19. And and he just exploded all of my notions of what art should be. That's how I started. And it was more in performing arts. And then I decided, okay, well, more the visual art seems to be where I'll settle.
Okay, I think another question here.
I'd just like to go back to the Victorial Elevation. I'm familiar with the one you did in Dublin. I was on the internet having a go at that. I believe the figures were something like over 500,000 people clocked onto that.
That's right.
14,000 artworks were created. I can understand people participating when something is in front of them, like the shadows. Have you any theories about why people participate sitting in a room in their house on the other side of the world?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. In the case of Dublin, it was particularly interesting because, of course, there's an Irish diaspora. And so one of the things that we found in Dublin, which was different to previous ones, is that a lot of people from Australia or from Canada or from wherever were kind of logging in and sending their messages out back to their family in Dublin. So that was a neat sort of bridge, if you will. So that was definitely one reason why we saw a lot of participation in the Dublin project. I think ultimately, I don't know the exact answer to that, why they do it. I know that I try to make it, I try to give people a reason to be there. So once you're there, you can actually see, first of all, you can see the live video and who's controlling the piece. But secondly, you know, you get this website made with your messages. And then what people do is they send messages to each other through the system and create web pages for them. One of the issues with Victorial Elevation is all of the archives are still online at alzado.net. And routinely I get these messages of people who have broken up and they want to remove that page that they created. So I spend an enormous amount of time just managing those memories and just basically deleting. But I have to say, Victorial has a very substantial problem, which I'm not happy about, which is you still, as much as I want to democratize or open up the project for people to participate, in Victorial, you still need to have this interface, which is solitary, and there's this discrepancy between you working on it and then the actual show. I mean, Aaron Betsky once said, and sadly he's right, but at the time I thought he was a bastard. He said, well, you know, to what extent are you not just Albert Speer times 500,000, right? And there's a good point to that, because in the end, that asymmetry is present in the project. I've now, so with something like Body Movies or with other projects that I'm working with now, the immediacy of the interface needs to be really, really clear. So, for example, there's a project in Japan that I did with cell phones, where you actually send text messages to each other and they get converted into flashes of light that bounce around and you can catch them with your cell phone. What's beautiful about that at the time that I did that in Japan is that 98% of the people in Japan had a cell phone and could actually be on site actually controlling the installation. So that was a nice way to try and fix that asymmetry that we had in Victoria. Ultimately, it's a big rush. You know, you go into this project and you're invited to control 180,000 watts of power somewhere else, and so you get this, you know, little moment where your name is on a big screen, And these lights are controlled by you. So there might be just that Warholian sense of your little moment of control.
I guess I'm just thinking about, I love this kind of work, but at the moment, of course, we're being forced to think always about the greenhouse gases and stuff. Mm. So are you sort of anticipating that this kind of large-scale, obviously very consumptive kind of work, that you're going to have to change strategies in terms of finding sponsors or in terms of the perhaps, I don't know, greening the work to some degree? What are you thinking about?
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's a really important work. I mean, living in Canada, you know, you're constantly sort of reminded of these issues. When I did a project similar to these in Toronto, one of the things, well, we did many things. The first thing we did is we used biodiesel generators to control the entire installation so that at least there was a sustainable source of power. Second thing we did is we did a calculation on how much a hockey game actually consumes in terms of electricity. So a lot of people were like, oh, this is a waste and whatever. And it turns out that we actually consumed a tenth of what a hockey game actually consumes. So I just reminded people, well, people, yes, this is a lot of power. It's a tenth of what a hockey game consumes. And then ultimately, there was a third thing that we did. Oh, and then one of the things that we did is we dedicated a very large portion, a portion of the budget for a zero footprint program, so that all of the carbon offsets of the entire installation would be, sort of offset by this program that does carbon sequestration or whatever, just to sort of be consistent with that, you know, with this idea of trying to green it up. But I think it's very important to do these comparisons to hockey or whatever, because it's just a question of where we placed our emphasis, you know. And I'm all for greening my projects, but so should we all do that in general. If there were a permanent project, I'd be more concerned, because permanent projects, you really need to think about the longevity of them and so on and so forth. So when I have a large project like that, it only works over a couple of hours a night or something like that. But yeah, different strategies to address that.
Any other questions? Malenti?
Hi, Rafael. I'd like to move the discussion a bit to more maybe to the field of aesthetics. I think in response to Julianne's question, you mentioned that the Duchampian notion of the gaze, and but in terms of the white cube, in terms of the gallery, that certainly doesn't exist anymore. I mean, like, we don't have audience that's willing to enter into this ritual of the gaze. We have an attention deficit. People come in, stay there for a minute, and leave. So there is no gaze. Maybe in the public art domain, there is more of a gaze because the arena is much bigger. It is the heavens. It is celestial. But in the white gallery, we cannot just keep it. And I think just in terms of how you're positioning the explanation of what you're doing, I think maybe the closest to what you were explaining tonight is the Flusserian notion of the apparatus and the indistinguishability in the apparatus of the operator operandi complex, where you have both the man and the machine working together, the interface and the human being.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, the idea of collaboration is a very important part, because in fact, as you're working with these technologies, you realize that, I mean, if you've developed them, whatever, but even if you've developed them, you're establishing a relationship with technologies which are not neutral. So as you work with the internet, you have to know that it comes from communications and control technologies of the Pentagon. And it is important to realize that as you work with under those parameters, you're establishing a collaboration with those prejudices and biases that are already in those technologies. So for instance, in the case of surveillance, which I think it's a very important subject, and I've looked at the work of people that I admire very much, like Julia Scher or Dan Graham, or people who have worked with this surveillance technology. The reality reality is that the kind of surveillance mechanisms that they were looking at was closed circuit TV. It's like you'd have a camera and you'd have a viewer of that camera. But today, the situation is much more ominous. We have now with Patriot Act and Homeland Security, these cameras now do things like try and determine our ethnic background. Or they do things like, for example, try and see detect our face against a database of suspicious individuals. So the degree to which these cameras have inbred into them the prejudices is a really drastic and very real sort of part of making those technologies. So as we worked with these technologies, you need to know you're collaborating with and complicit with a lot of those different agendas. So I think that ultimately the position that I have with technology, and I'm sorry, I'm losing it. The position I have with technology is I work with it not because it's new, but because it's inevitable. So in other words, it's everywhere around us. The Canadians would say the McLuhan idea of technology as a second skin. You know, we don't know. I don't know how many hours of TV you watch a day, but in Canada, it's like 4.5 hours of TV a day per person. So the idea of what would we be before TV is non-existent. Pol Pot, try that. So we work with technology just because it's a language of globalization. It's just what is.
Thanks for that, but just a little follow-up question. I mean, like, in terms, I understand the socio-political connotations, but just in terms of your advice to the young artists that are entering this arena which you have mastered, what would your advice be? How to aestheticize these same concerns that they have? How to approach it? Because this is not something which is very easily learned at art schools. I mean, it needs a constant evolution. It needs sort of constant dialogue. And Australia is very far away from the discourses.
Yeah. I don't have very many lessons to teach anybody. Like I'm literally just sort of going with a lot with intuition and just trying to materialize my nightmares and my obsessions. Advice.
Drink wine, I think.
Wine is good. Wine is definitely good. Yeah, be passionate about like getting it wrong, you know. I don't know, like I think to be very proactive about, you know, being passionate about the uselessness of what you're doing and about the capability that you'll get it all wrong. It's a really good thing.
Melinda has one quick question.
It's a fun question, so it's okay. I'm interested about how large-scale public work gets consumed by the museum, and Julianne was mentioning that you're being collected by the Museum of Mona, which we call the Museum of Sex and Death here. I'm wondering what work is going in and how that process is.
They bought Pulse Room, so the Venice piece. So they're going to install that permanently. I think that now it's called the Museum of Old and New Art, which I think is so funny. It's like, well, you don't leave anything out, you know? It's like, okay. I liked Sex and Death. That sounded better. So they're going to show that project. It really depends on the project. Some of the pieces, like for instance, the Mona piece, I am completely and absolutely married to the incandescent light bulb. As you know, I think in Australia, it's in 2012, they're completely illegal. And one of the things which I hope the gallerists told Mona is that the moment that you can't get any more incandescent light bulbs, that piece must die. And the reason I mention that is because when you're working with museums, they're thinking about 40 years from now, like what's going to happen in 40 years. Other works, like the one that the Tate bought, is a project called Subtitle Public, which basically brands people as they walk around in the space. And when the Tate bought it, I gave them the four projectors, and they said, oh, you know, four projectors, you know, let's get some spares and whatever. And I'm like, no. The projector, you just get whatever comes up with, you know, like the project is the instructions that will make that piece work. So in that sense, you can reinvent the project to preserve it over time. But I think ultimately the artist needs to be very clear about whether the technology is specific and must be preserved, or whether it can migrate into future systems. So the best example of that was the, you know, in Namjoon Paik's Buddha looking at himself in the monitor, the question is, soon that monitor will die and there won't be any cathode ray tubes anymore. And the question to Namjoon Paik would have been, well, can we replace this by a flat screen, you know? And the only person who could have answered that was Namjoon Paik, because maybe he's just interested in the sort of circularity of vision or whatever, he would have been fine with it, or he would have been very precious about that particular cabinet. So by being very upfront about questions like that, the piece can remain preserved, if you will, because I've been against preservation and about against collections and whatever, and I've sold out, right? So now I'm like backpedaling and trying to find a way to say, look, yes, okay, museums can collect this work, provided that they are presented in a performative aspect, that the essence of the performance is maintained, then I'm okay with it.
I think it's okay to say, like, you've got a family to support.
Yeah.
You know? So we're just going to break for 5 or 10 minutes to have a drink and then back in here for the screenplay launch. And then also, if we have the full program, which is at the end of the road, so please pick that up. And if you can't stay for the launch, please come back at 11 a.m. tomorrow for the where we'll have our second day. So thanks very much to Raphael for a really fantastic talk.